White looked gratified. He refilled his glass from the margarita pitcher. The more dangerous I appear, the more the politicians have to campaign against. Unfortunately, Mr. Navarre, contrary to popular belief, I've found that direct retaliation against such people is most often counterproductive. There was a knock at the door. White uncrossed his legs. The audience was concluded. And now, if you'll excuse me, Mr. Navarre, either you will choose to believe me that I had nothing to do with your father's death, or you will not. Nevertheless, my boy, there's nothing more I can do for you. I have a keynote address to deliver in exactly 20 minutes. I decided something. You don't have it. The other disc. White almost played dumb. I could see him change his mind just as he opened his mouth. No, he said. I do not. I tried to stand up and was surprised to find I actually could. Assuming I believe you, I said, assuming Asante was Chef's partner inside City Hall on the Travis Center project, that still doesn't tell me who the other side is, the ones who control Chef Construction. White gave me a look I couldn't read. Sadness. Maybe even pity. As I said, my boy, some cages are better left unrattled. We studied one another. Maybe that was when I had the first glimmering of understanding about where it was all going. Maybe that's why I chose not to push him any further. When I left, Guy White was listening to Emery's rundown of their afternoon schedule, benefits, cocktail parties, an award for good citizenship from a local nonprofit. Emery was cleaning another gun as he talked. Guy White was staring out the sunny windows at his gardens, smiling a little sadly now. Chapter 57. When I looked out my living room window the next morning, Ralph Arguello's maroon Lincoln sat in front of number 90. When I came up to the driver's window, the black glass rolled down and mota smoke rolled out. Ralph grinned up at me like a happily stoned Diablo. "Do I know you?" I said.
"Get in."
I didn't ask why. We drove into Monta Vista on Woodlawn, past rows of dying palm trees that leaned over the boulevard like they hadn't quite woken up yet. Mansions squatted next to shacks. The signs and storefronts gradually turned bilingual. Finally, Ralph looked across at me.
"I'm meeting a guy at 8:30, he said.
"Yeah?" He nodded.
"Business deal, Vato. New territory."
We pulled up in front of a dark blue building that had been plopped down in the middle of an acre of asphalt on the corner of Blanco and French. The yellow backlit sign in front promised guns and loans. At least that's what it used to say before half the letters had been broken out with rocks. A tall Anglo man in a wrinkled black suit was waiting at the door, smiling. From the bruises on his face, I wondered if he'd been pelted at the same time as his sign. Most of the marks were fading into yellow around his cheeks and neck, but he still had a blue-black knot the size of a pecan over his left eyebrow. The smile just made him look more grotesque.
"Mr. Arguello," the tall man said as we got out of the car.
When he swallowed, his Adam's apple went up a few inches and stayed that way. He shook Ralph's hand a little too enthusiastically.
"Lamar," said Ralph. "Let's see it."
Lamar fumbled with some keys. He unlocked two rows of burglary bars first, then the main door. The inside of the pawn shop smelled like cigars and dust. Grimy glass cases filled with guns, stereo parts, and jewelry made a U around the back walls. A few beat-up guitars and saxophones had been lynched from the ceiling. Ralph inhaled, as if to get the full atmosphere of the place into his lungs. Lamar smiled nervously, waiting for his approval.
"Books," said Ralph.
Lamar nodded and went to open the office. I plucked a string on one of the convicted Yamaha guitars. It rattled loosely, like a slinky. Ralph looked at me.
"Well?"
"Sure," I said. "Some lace curtains, a love seat or two. I can see it." Ralph grinned.
"Ethan Allen, maybe."
"Levitz."
"I'm sold. You can do all my shops, Vato." Lamar came back and spent a few minutes with Ralph over the books. I looked at the guns, then watched the traffic in and out of the flop house across the street for a while. Finally, Ralph shook hands again, and Lamar handed over the keys. Lamar started to leave, but on his way out he looked at me, hesitated, then came over. He was so nervous his Adam's apple disappeared above his jawline. The yellow bruises turned pink. He started.
"Hey, man, it just wasn't necessary. That's all I got to say."
Then he left. I looked at Ralph for an explanation. His eyes floated behind his round lenses, impossible to read. The smile didn't change.
"Loco," Ralph said. "I guess he thought you were somebody else, man."
"I guess." We went back to Ralph's new office, a cheaply paneled closet with a window AC unit, two metal folding chairs, and an unfinished particle board desk. Ralph sat down and started looking through the drawers.
"You always do property deals in under 5 minutes with no paperwork."
Ralph shrugged.
"Details, Vato. That's for later."
He fished out a half-empty bottle of Wild Irish Rose and a few .38 rounds, then a stack of ragged manila folders. When he was satisfied there was nothing else, he sat back in his chair and smiled at me.
"Okay," he said. "So tell me about it."
"What do you want first? You've got your choice of 3 murders, blackmail, several pissed-off policemen." Ralph shook his head.
"I know all that. I mean, the Chinese woman. Tell me about her."
I stared at him for a few seconds. I guess I'd forgotten who I was talking to. Ralph would have heard just about everything that had happened to me over the last week. He'd know about the dead bodies, the heat, the people I'd talked to. But the question about Maya took me off guard. I must have looked pretty irritated. Ralph laughed.
"Come on, Vato. All I want to know is this. Are you still looking for Lillian, or aren't you? 'Cause if you're not, that's cool. I can take you home and save us some trouble."
"Some trouble?" He shrugged. "And if I'm still looking?" He thumbed through the stack of manila folders. The action sent puffs of dust up in front of his face. He kept looking at me.
"Is that a yes?"
"That's a yes." He shook his head, like I'd made a bad business decision.
"Then, this is between you and me. A couple of people came up to me over the last 2 days telling me about this guy that turned up dead, this pendejo, Eddie Moraga, who took Lillian that Sunday."
"You've been sitting on information for the last 2 days?" I tried to keep my voice even. Ralph leaned forward and spread his hands on the desk, palms up.
"Hey, Vato. Every time I come to see you, I find the man there. Or you're with him. It kind of cuts down on the quality time I want to spend with you, you know?"
I nodded for him to go on.
"Okay. So first I talk to this guy, old friend of Eddie's. He's pretty shaken up about it all being in the papers Friday morning. So, $50 later, and he says, yeah, he talked to Eddie on Monday night. He was all alone at this bar down on Culebra, talking about this hot date he'd had the night before. A date, Vato. Like this rich white girl would go out with him."
I couldn't talk. I was remembering a rapist I'd brought down for a client of Terrence and Goldman 2 years ago. A rapist who talked about his dates with his victims, two of whom later turned up in garbage cans. Ralph must have thought that through, too. He'd been on the streets long enough. He looked at my expression.
"Hey, man," he said.
He probably wanted to say something consoling. He shifted in his chair.
"Like I said, if you were with this other lady, I could have just walked from this, Vato. This isn't easy shit."
"Keep going." For a minute, we both stared at the bottle of Wild Rose, almost tempted. Then Ralph sighed.
"Yeah. Anyway, so Eddie was talking about coming into some money from this lady. I don't know, man, maybe not like she was paying him,
Maybe he was just making a joke, like he was getting paid to take her away for somebody else. Anyway, Eddie said that this lady was a fire eater. Like you couldn't turn your back on her or she'd either steal your shit or kick you in the balls. That's what he said. And check this out, Vato. He said they went to this place he knew, a construction site he worked at. Real intimate.
I shook my head. There's only a few thousand of those, Ralph.
No, man, he said. I'm not finished.
What else?
Like I said, some other people talk to me, some people who like a low profile. Keep that in mind.
I thought about Ralph and his 357 Magnum. Low profile, like you?
More than me, Vato. These people, they're in the car business, you know?
As in Chop Shop? S.A., second highest auto theft rate in the country? Ralph shrugged.
I wouldn't know, Vato. But I wouldn't tell these people they're in second place, man. It might offend them.
Okay. Ralph nodded.
So, anyway, I ask around about this green Chevy Eddie's supposed to drive. His friends tell me it's a 65, fully restored. So I think, sure, the police are just going to find this Chevy sitting around on the streets after a week.
So your friends just happened to come across it, strictly legit.
They were about to paint it white, man.
Ralph's frown told me he didn't approve of the color choice.
So I told them to wait a while. Leave it like it is.
And how was that? He looked at me, grinning again. Then he took out a brown paper bag from his pocket and poured the contents onto the desk. White powder. I didn't even have time to misread it as cocaine before Ralph shook his head.
No, Vato, check it out.
I looked closer.
It was all over the wheel casings, man. The outside was washed off, but it was caked on thick inside. You know that rainstorm that came through last week?
I smelled it. I tasted it. It seemed to be powdered rock. I give. Ralph shook his head, disappointed.
Oh, man, he said. You didn't live there? You didn't go to Heights with your shoes covered in it? We lived in it, Vato. Mother of God, my old man's lungs collapsed because of this shit. It's lime powder, man, pure lime.
It took a minute for that to register. As in the stuff they make cement from, I said.
Okay, Vato,
he said, trying to lead me to what he was thinking. Couldn't that be any construction site? Ralph laughed and started repacking his desk.
You goddamn white collars. No, man, who mixes cement on site? That much lime only comes from the factory.
As usual, the answer was something under my nose, something I'd lived next to most of my life. When I put it together, I almost couldn't believe how ridiculous the idea was, which probably meant it was the truth. Ralph and I looked at each other. God knows I didn't have much to smile about. All I'd probably learned was where to find the body of a woman I thought I loved. But I looked at Ralph, grinning like a fiend, and I started smiling anyway. It's pretty slim, man, I said.
It ain't going to get any fatter, man, Ralph said. You got to jump on it.
God damn Cementville, I said. Ralph grinned.
There's no place like home.
Chapter 58. The sign on the fence outside the factory said, Chef Construction, keep out. There was no movement inside the barbed wire. No trucks, no lights in the broken windows of the old factory. Ralph and I sat in his car for a while and just watched while the Cadillacs went by. Old men going to the golf course, women going to shop Albertsons and Steinmart. The new subdivision, Lincoln Heights, had its own private security, and after the same patrolman drove by us twice, real slow, Ralph and I decided it was time to move on. Tonight, I said. I can't do anything until then without being seen by half the north side. Neither could they. Ralph followed the security car with his eyes until it was out of sight.
How you know who they is, man?
One way to find out. As if he were reading my mind, Ralph reached into his back seat and produced a cell phone. I dialed a number I'd memorized from Lillian's date book and got an answering machine. "I'm thinking about visiting Cementville," I said. Then I hung up. Ralph started the Lincoln and pulled it into traffic.
"You got the right person. They got to move her tonight," he said. "Or at least they got to look."
"Yeah.
You want some backup?"
I started to say no, then I decided not to be hasty. "I'll call you." Ralph nodded, then handed me a card.
"Two numbers," he said. "Cell phone and beeper."
"A beeper?" Ralph grinned.
"Hey, vato, the doctor is in."
When Ralph dropped me at home, it was early afternoon. Several hours until dark when I could actually do something. Rather than go crazy watching Robert Johnson run circles around the living room, I took my sword and walked down the street to the edge of Brackenridge Park. The cicadas were the only thing stirring. Nobody was stupid enough to walk over a block in this heat, much less exercise in it. I crossed Broadway and jogged over to the Witt Museum, where the old iron gates of the alligator gardens were hanging off their hinges. One of the less successful tourist attractions in San Antonio, the gardens had seen ticket sales to the public schools drop off dramatically after the alligators had eaten a few hands off the trainers. Then the place had faded into obscurity and eventually closed. The gates were easy to climb, though, and the dried basin where the gators had been kept made a perfect shady Tai Chi surface. I did an hour and a half of high stance until I was sweating and about to pass out from the heat. Then I rested for a few minutes and did another 2 hours of sword. By the time the sun started going down, I'd cleared my mind and worked the kinks out of my body. I knew what the plan was. I bought some provisions from the Lincoln Heights Albertsons. Then I drove down to Vandiver and traded cars with my mother, more or less. Actually, she'd taken her Volvo somewhere, so I had to leave the keys to the VW in her mailbox and hotwire Jess's truck. With luck, he'd need to run for beer between TV shows and would find it missing long before I could get it back to him. My evening was starting to look up. Jess's monstrous black Ford must have known I wasn't wearing the obligatory Stetson and boots required to ride such a beast. It bucked and kicked all the way down Nacogdoches until I pulled it over into the scrub brush on base, just behind the old freight entrance to Cementville. "Whoa, Nelly," I told the truck. The engine shuddered resentfully and died. Just as well. Another few blocks like that, and I would have had to shoot it anyway. I waited outside the fence for a couple of hours. What I was looking for didn't materialize. I ate an Albertson's deli sandwich. I had some terrible Italian bottled water. On this side of the old factory, there were fewer high-priced new homes, which meant there were fewer nervous security guards. After dark, traffic died down to almost nothing. Nobody seemed to care about me and my semi-stolen truck. It was full dark when the chef's cherry red Mustang passed me and slowed down a quarter mile up the road, right outside the old loading docks. I couldn't see the driver very well when he got out. He unchained the gates, got back in the Mustang, and drove through. I was about to drive back to the Albertsons payphone when I noticed the cargo holder by the stick shift. No chance, I thought. I opened it anyway and found Jess's deep, dark, yuppie secret. The real cowboys would have laughed them off the open range if they'd known. Suddenly liking Jess more than I cared to admit, I picked up his cellular phone and dialed Ralph's number. He picked up almost immediately. "Annie, get your gun," I said. The line was silent for a moment.
"Give me 10 minutes.
Ralph hung up. Exactly 11 minutes later, the maroon U-boat slid to a stop behind the truck. Ralph stepped up to the shotgun window and leaned his head into the cab.
"Nice wheels, vaquero. You chewing Red Man yet?"
The gun rack wouldn't fit on my VW.
"No shit."
Ralph had changed into work clothes, Levi's and a loose black shirt, untucked. I didn't need to ask what he was carrying underneath. I pointed out the red Mustang up ahead, now dark and silent, just inside the chain-link fence. Ralph nodded.
"Meet you up there," he said. Then he disappeared.
By the time I got out of the truck and followed the fence up to the gate, Ralph was crouched in a patch of wild cilantro. He had a straight razor in one hand. In his other hand were four severed tire valve stems. He held them up, grinned, then tossed them through the fence. We watched the old factory for a while. The weed-covered shipping yard, the storage silos, the grimy windows with most of the glass broken out. The only thing moving were the fireflies. They were everywhere tonight, pulsing off and on in the hackberry bushes around the fence like defective Christmas lights. Ralph nudged my arm. We watched the yellow cone of a flashlight aimed from the factory roof slide up the right side of one of the huge smokestacks and illuminate a metal-rung ladder that led up to the wraparound catwalk just below the red O in Alamo. The light clicked off abruptly. I could hear Ralph swallow.
"There's a small maintenance room up there where they wired up the sign," he said. "I think."
His voice sounded like it was closing up all of a sudden. I couldn't see much in the dark, but I could have sworn he was turning pale. "Ralphus?"
"Heights, man. I can't handle them."
There was a quivery tone to his voice that might have been funny under other circumstances, like Ralph trying to imitate somebody who was really scared. But you don't laugh at your friend's phobias, at least not when your friend is holding a straight razor. "Okay," I said. "We'll deal with it when we get there."
"Shit, Vato. I didn't think..."
"Forget it, Ralphus. Any other chain gates between here and there, you think?" Ralph showed me a small but wickedly sharp set of metal cutters. His grin came back slowly.
"Not anymore, Vato."
Minutes later, we were crossing the train tracks under the shadow of the factory walls. The ground was littered with dried gobs of cement, old railroad ties, scrap metal, dry sage grass. None of it conducive to sneaking around in the dark. It was my turn to be embarrassed. When I stumbled the second time, Ralph had to grab me by the shirt to keep me from sliding face first into a quarry pit. The sound of the loosened gravel skittering into the hole echoed off the building like a standing ovation. We froze. No sounds. No light from above. Ralph's childhood memories came through. He found a set of metal doors around the side of the building that were standing wide open. What moonlight there was fell in a square over the bottom steps of a spiral stairwell. We went inside.
"This goes to the roof," he said. "I guess, yeah. There was talk about saving the old smokestacks for a restaurant or something. You could store something up there for a long time and none of the workers would think to bother it."
I looked up at the rickety stairwell.
"You okay with this?" I whispered. "Don't ask, Vato. Just start climbing."
By the way, every creak and groan of the staircase echoed around as we ascended. I figured the interior of the building must have been one massive chamber, stripped to a shell when the plant shut down. I gave up counting steps when I got to 100. I gave up counting missing bolts that were supposed to secure the stairwell to the wall when I got to 1. More, I didn't want to know. Somehow, Ralph stayed behind me. After what seemed like 1,000 years, we came to a door that was open to the roof. I stepped out and immediately flattened my body against the wall of the roof house to avoid making a silhouette. Ralph crawled out and sat down, breathing heavily.
"I'm not getting up," he said. "No way."
The view was tremendous. To the south, the lights of McAllister Freeway snaking through the darkness of the Olmos Basin, then emptying into the hazy glow of the downtown skyline. The buildings there were all lit up gold, except for the stark white tower of the Americas, the proverbial needle in the haystack. In the opposite direction, Loop 410 made a glittering curve of hotels, malls, singles apartment complexes around the north side, Loopland, as it was not so affectionately called. Beyond that was the dark rise of the Balcones Escarpment, and more storm clouds rolling in. Ralph was not impressed. He sat cursing the horizon quietly in Spanish. After being in the dark of the building, the moonlit roof was easier to see across. A few yards away to the south, The tar had sagged and caught a sizable lake of rainwater from the last storm. It had almost evaporated after several days in the sun, but not quite. There was still enough moisture around the edges to track footprints, at least one set, leading toward the edge of the roof. From there, an old steel catwalk spanned 30 yards of empty space to the ladder on the side of the smokestack. About one story up, the ladder dead-ended at an oval door that resembled a submarine hatch. The door was ajar, with light seeping out from behind it. I looked at Ralph, who was either invoking God or preparing to throw up.
"I'm okay," he croaked.
Then I looked back up and saw the door open. A familiar face in the porthole.
"I wish I could say the same," I said.
Chapter 59. With the light behind her, her hair looked disheveled, like straw. She was wearing an old t-shirt and black sweatpants smeared with paint. I couldn't see her face well, but she was moving slowly, like a sleepwalker. Kellen hadn't even changed out of his black chauffeur's outfit. He got onto the ladder first and guided Lillian down onto the rungs, cradling her with his body so she wouldn't fall. It took them a long time to descend to the catwalk.
"Thank God," Ralph whispered.
He said a prayer to the patron saint of acrophobics, then crept around to one side of the roof house while I crept to the other. We waited. Lillian started talking as they approached, but it didn't sound much like her. She giggled, then spoke in a low voice. Kellen shushed her the way you would a child. I made a silent promise to force-feed Kellen whatever the hell they'd doped her up with. Then they were at the doorway, close enough for me to catch Lillian's scent, her perspiration, the way her skin smelled on a hot night. Maybe that's what tripped up my timing. Whatever it was, Kellen froze. It should have been over when Ralph stepped around, bringing the .357 over his head. Instead, Kellen pushed Lillian into him, then knocked Ralph's arm away. It's hard to send a Smith & Wesson Magnum flying. It's not exactly a light gun. Nevertheless, it flew. Lillian said something like, "Whoops," as she toppled into Ralph. Only Ralph's sheer terror of falling back into the stairwell kept them both on their feet. The 357 skittered across the tar and came to a stop somewhere in the shadows off to my left. I stepped out and immediately had to duck Kellen's right cross. So much for the surprise factor. I didn't think he was carrying, but I couldn't give him time to pull a weapon. Kellen stepped back, and I stuck to him like glue. That's the most disconcerting thing about fighting a Taiji opponent. You step back, they step forward. You advance, they retreat. You swing right, they disappear to the left. The whole time, they're only a few inches away, but you can't connect a punch. And they touch you almost the whole time. There's a hand on your shoulder, maybe, or fingertips on your chest, feeling exactly where the tension is, where you're going to move next. It's very annoying.
"Motherfucker,"
Kellen grumbled. I let him swing at me for a while, missing. We moved across the roof, into the water, back toward the roof house, back into the water. Meanwhile, Ralph got Lillian down the stairs. That was all that mattered, and Kellen was losing his cool.
"Get your goddamn hands off me," he yelled.
A left uppercut. I wasn't there. I kept moving with him, waiting for the right opening. It was going fine until I fell for a feint so obvious, Sifu Chen would have kicked me out of class for missing it. Kellen was learning his lesson. He jabbed right, got me to turn, then turned with me and embedded his left fist in my kidneys with the force of a 20-pound champagne cork. With a few seconds preparation, it's possible to compress the G into your diaphragm and take a hit like that with almost no pain at all, if I'd had a few seconds. Instead, I went down, just managing to hook Kellen's leg as he stepped back. He joined me in the dirty water. We were both flat on our butts for a moment, cursing. But unlike me, Kellen wasn't cradling a hot bowling ball in his intestines. By the time I stumbled to my knees, he was on his feet and running. I wiped the roof sludge out of my eyes and looked back at the door to the stairwell. No Kellen. Just an empty doorway. I heard Lillian's giggles echoing from somewhere down below. Wait a minute.
feet banging on metal. I turned. Kellen was just reaching the far side of the catwalk. My body was telling me to stay doubled over, to curl up in the rainwater and take a nap. Instead, I forced myself to get up and follow. I didn't have Ralph's phobia. Not until I stepped onto the catwalk and it started bouncing up and down, creaking under my weight. Below, there was nothing but five stories of blackness. The smokestack loomed out of the void, white and huge. Its diameter was big enough to house a tennis court. Above me, it rose another five stories like some massive anti-aircraft gun. Kellen was only a few feet up the ladder now. He seemed to be having trouble with his right ankle. I made it across. The concrete sides of the smokestack were surprisingly smooth and cold. The ladder rungs were wet. Kellen was breathing hard above me, still cursing. His hand was about two rungs below the bottom of the door. I didn't know why he wanted back in that room. I just knew, if it was more important to him than fighting over Lillian, I couldn't let him get there. I got his ankle, the right one, as he was pulling himself into the doorway. He kicked back reflexively, and I twisted, using his own kick to bend the joint. He screamed. It would have been perfect if I hadn't lost my balance. For an instant I was hanging on only by my left hand, my feet dangling freely over nothing at all. My other hand let go of Kellen, then grabbed for a rung. I scraped against concrete instead. I felt my fingernails rip. I was watching the Tower of the Americas tilting sideways in the distance, wondering why it was like that. I wondered if that revolving restaurant at the top of the tower was still open, the place my dad used to go for his birthdays. I was also thinking, what an inane final thought that would be. Then my foot found a rung. Kellen could have kept me out of the doorway easily if he'd been there. He wasn't. When I pulled myself into the tiny cement chamber, he was limping off to the left toward a milk crate full of hanging files that was sitting on the floor next to another metal door. On top of the files was a revolver. The maintenance area wasn't much more than a hallway. It was only about 6 feet deep, but lengthwise it curved around with the circumference of the smokestack, ending in a metal door 10 feet down on either end. The fuse boxes and metal cables along the inner wall were probably once used to light up the Alamo cement signs on the sides of the stacks. There was also some bedding on the floor, an open wicker picnic basket, some clothes scattered about. Kellen heard me behind him and turned. His uniform was covered with sludge and white dust from the side of the smokestack. His short cropped hair looked like a Brillo pad that had just been used, and his face, for once, was anything but impassive. I suddenly realized that he was much older than I'd first thought, closer to 50 than 30. He was pointing the gun at me now. You can never be faster than the squeeze of the trigger, no matter how fast you can hit or kick. I knew it, he knew it. I wasn't stupid. I smiled and spread my hands, admitting defeat. He smiled back at me. Then I kicked the .38 out of his hand. The shot went past my left ear and tore a chunk of concrete out of the wall. The gun landed in the corner. For a second, Kellen looked amazed at how stupid I had been, right before I pulled him forward and flipped him onto the concrete on his back, hard. I'll give Kellen credit. He got up. My right hand was starting to get sticky from the blood. The ruined fingertips throbbed so bad I was afraid to look. Is the lady of the house in? I asked Kellen, who was now backing up to the exit. He wiped the grime off his forehead with the back of his hand, then glanced over at the gun. He smiled at me.
No offense, man, he said. But you don't know shit about what's going on here.
Fill me in. He shook his head.
I was there, he said, still smiling almost pleasantly. With that stupid shit Halcom we set up for the fall. I was driving. Pretty damn funny watching Randall plow that fat fuck into his front lawn. Your face, man.
He started laughing. Then he went for me, figuring I was disoriented. I was. Tai Ji would have demanded that I use his own force to send him into the wall behind. I didn't. I pushed back, force against force, a totally incorrect approach. Kellen was obviously appalled. At least he looked that way,
when he went out the door. His hands kept reaching for something, but there wasn't anything there. There was no sound at all until he reached the bottom, and even then nothing much. A faint metallic clap, like the echo of a snare drum. Nothing nearly as loud as my heartbeats. I sat down on the blankets. I wrapped my bloody hand inside one of Lillian's old t-shirts. I needed to get out of there. Instead, I sat and stared out the door. I must have gotten up and looked around after a while. I remember looking through a few of the files in the milk crate, learning all about the real owners of Chef Construction. All I really needed to do was look in the picnic basket. There were a few slices left, wrapped in a linen napkin and smelling wonderful. Obviously, fresh baked today. The lady of the house had not been in, but she'd sent some banana bread. Chapter 60. It was a long ride to the west side in Jess's pickup truck. The engine was bucking resentfully. My hand was bleeding. Ralph was still shaking from acrophobia, too badly to drive, and Lillian was sandwiched between us, mumbling lines from Dr. Seuss. So far, she hadn't recognized either of us, but she seemed perfectly happy to go for a ride. After her second complete and flawless recitation of Green Eggs and Ham, Ralph and I looked across at each other.
"Eho," he swore.
"Yeah," I said.
I tried to force my mind not to think about what I'd learned up there in the Alamo cement smokestacks. It didn't work. By the time we pulled up in front of the Arguello family home off McCullough, I'd put it all together, and I was trying like hell to deny that the pieces fit. But they did. Mama Arguello was quite possibly the shortest, widest person in the world. She was standing in the doorway, the entire doorway, when we drove up. Her faded plaid dress barely managed to contain her awesome cleavage. Her hair was pinned up in a black wedge. Her eyes, like Ralph's, were hidden behind thick prescription glasses. The fact that her hands were covered in flour didn't stop her from grabbing Ralph by the cheeks and dragging his face down to kiss hers.
"Aye," she said, "he's my boy in one piece, an amazing thing."
Then she came to hug me. Maybe she remembered me from high school, I'm not sure. I think she would have hugged me anyway. Her neck was bristly and smelled like chocolate. Then she hugged Lillian, who giggled. Mama Arguello looked at Lillian again, more critically this time.
"Aye," she said, "what kind of drugs are these?"
I showed her the family-sized bottle of Valium I'd retrieved from the smokestack. She scowled, gave it back to me, and asked me to read the label. I did. Finally, she announced her remedy.
"Raspberry leaf tea."
Then she was gone. Ralph and I got Lillian to lie down on the plastic-covered couch. She was frowning now, yawning, starting to look around in confusion. I decided to take that as a good sign. I sat and spoke to her for a minute while Ralph used the phone. He had some friends who were extremely interested in retrieving his car for him, especially since it was right next to a beautiful red Mustang that just needed some new tire valve stems. Then I used the phone. I called and asked Larry Drapewski a favor. When I came back, I stroked Lillian's hair until her eyes closed, and she started snoring lightly.
"What do you think, Vato?"
Ralph asked. I looked down at Lillian asleep, with her face relaxed, her reddish-blonde hair tousled and her freckles dark. She looked about 16 years old, and I should know. I remembered her at 16, and 20, and now. Jesus. Half my life I'd either been in love with her or convincing myself that I wasn't, which made it strange now. I kissed her forehead one more time, then asked Ralph, "Will your mom mind taking care of her for tonight?" Ralph grinned.
"She'll have her up and helping with the cleaning in no time, Vato. You watch."
"Will you stay with her?"
"You look at yourself in the mirror lately, Vato."
"It's easier if I take it alone from here, and I want Lillian to be with somebody she knows if she comes around." He didn't like it.
"Take a piece, at least."
"Not where I'm going, Ralphus." He shook his head.
Jesus, man, you're a hard-headed EO puta.
That's when Mama Arguello came back in with the tea and smacked Ralph on the arm for bad language. I tried to leave, but Mama Arguello insisted on bandaging my hand first and cleaning my face with a dish towel. She fed me homemade tortillas until my stomach stopped revolting. By the time I got out of her living room, it was almost 10 p.m.
"We'll take care of her for you, Mr. Ralph's friend," Mama insisted. "You don't worry."
Then she went back inside to force-feed Lillian some raspberry leaf tea. Ralph walked me out to the truck. "Sorry, Ralphus," I said. He just shrugged.
"Hey, man, just means I got to be here when my stepdad gets home. He comes in drunk, I'll try not to kill him in front of Lillian."
"I'd appreciate that."
"Yeah."
I started the engine, which came out of the stall already bucking mad. Ralph shook his head and grinned.
"Some sorry wheels, man. You even know who you're going to see?"
"Yeah. The ghost of a father." I looked back in the pickup bed where a milk crate full of old files was rattling around. That's when Ralph's stepdad drove up, parking his Chevy half on the curb.
"Yeah, well," said Ralph, looking over. "If it turns out to be mine, let me know. I kind of miss the old man."
Then he turned away and headed up the steps of the front porch. I think he locked the door behind him. Chapter 61. I almost decided to scrap my plans when I saw the car in the driveway. Dan Sheff's silver BMW was parked crooked, pulled so close to the house that its nose was buried in the thick pyracantha bushes. Someone hadn't closed the passenger door hard enough to turn off the dash lights. As I got closer, I could hear the BMW complaining about the situation with a muffled eep. The house's porch light was off. I tried the black iron handle of the front door and found it securely fastened. At the far end of the house, where the study was, one heavily curtained window glowed orange around the edges. Otherwise, no sign of life. I took the side path around the house, crouching under hackberry branches and trying not to trip on the uneven flagstones. The poodle in the neighbor's yard yapped at me once without much enthusiasm. I jumped a short chain-link gate, then did a little searching on the back porch. The spare key for the kitchen door was still underneath the plaster St. Francis on the third step, where it had been 10 years before. Inside, the kitchen smelled faintly of banana bread and fresh-brewed tea. The microwave door was open, giving off just enough light to make the copper baking molds and the olive-green counter tiles glisten. I walked down the hallway, turned left into the main bedroom, and found what I was looking for with no trouble at all. The gun was in an unlocked nightstand drawer on the right-hand side of the bed. It was loaded, too. No points for safety awareness. I continued down the hall toward the voices that were coming from the study. 5 feet from the lighted doorway, I heard one of the people inside say,
"You did the right thing, kid."
The voice belonged to Jay Rivas, my best buddy at SAPD. That made things just about perfect. The ripped fingernails on my right hand were starting to throb against the bandages. My stomach ached. When I tried to move closer toward the entrance, my feet wouldn't cooperate. I found myself staring at family photos on the hallway wall, daguerreotypes of Victorian ancestors, Easter egg-colored Sears portraits from the 60s and 70s, a recent panorama from a family reunion. There was a time when I'd imagined my wedding pictures hanging here, maybe even pictures of kids happily accumulating dust and the odors of Thanksgiving dinners over the years. Looking at that photo collection now, I felt as if I were holding a hammer to it, about to cause a lot of noise and broken glass that wouldn't make me feel a damn bit better. When I stepped into the doorway, Zeke Cambridge was the first to notice me. He'd apparently had a hard day at the office. His black suit was rumpled, his collar loosened, and his tie twisted with the tag side out. His unshaven whiskers made a dark gray sheen along his jawline. He'd been pacing in front of the baby grand piano at the far end of the room and had already been looking at the doorway before I appeared. as if he were anxiously waiting for someone. I was not the person he was expecting. A few feet closer to me, Mrs. Cambridge and Dan Sheff sat on the couch, consoling one another. Dan had his back to me, but Mrs. Cambridge saw me. Her hands slipped off Dan's knee. She stood up. Her bright yellow sundress and day-glow plastic earrings seemed absurdly incongruous with her pinned-up gray hair, her pearl necklace, her white liver-spotted shoulders, and her morose, weary face. She looked like she'd been the victim of a failed makeover attempt by a much younger woman. Surprisingly, Dan looked better than I'd seen him in days. He was freshly showered and dressed, his blonde hair gleaming with gel, his khakis creased, his white Ralph Lauren button-down neatly starched and tucked in. Only his miserable expression hadn't changed. Jay Rivas stood behind Dan. Rivas looked better than I'd seen him in days, too, though for Jay that didn't mean much. He was sporting brown double-knit slacks and his usual silver and turquoise belt buckle and a white polyester shirt so thin that his armpit hair and the lines of his undershirt showed through. The real fashion statement for me, though, was the side-holstered 9mm Parabellum, the same kind of gun that had drilled holes in Eddie Moraga's eyes. The second disc, the one that had been taken from the Hilton over Bo Carnow's dead body, was sitting casually on top of a Country Living magazine on the coffee table, next to an untouched plate of banana bread and a pot of tea. Dan was staring at the CD, but he was so engrossed in his own thoughts, I think he would have stared at anything. Nobody else seemed to be paying the disc much attention. Jay patted Dan Sheff's shoulder roughly and said again, "You did the right thing." Then Rivas saw me out of the corner of his eye. He registered my face, then the .22 in my unbandaged left hand. His hands stayed where they were, one on Dan's shoulder, one hooked in his belt about an inch away from the handle of the Parabellum. Dan was the last to notice me. When he finally looked up, he didn't seem very surprised. He spoke as if we were continuing an old conversation. "I told them about my mother. They had to know." The Cambridges both looked at me intently, not saying a word. Even Rivas was silent. Dan glanced at each of them, frowning when he realized he was no longer the center of attention. Everybody else kept looking at me, at the single-shot Sheridan knockabout I was holding. "I'm going to set this right," Sheff tried to put some steel into his voice. "I don't care if it is my mother. I called Lieutenant Rivas. I told him everything." My own voice sounded papery. "Must be a real load off your conscience. I suppose the lieutenant suggested you talk with Lillian's parents. Rivas wanted to be present, of course." Dan sat up a little straighter. "My mother lied to them about Lillian. She tried to keep the police away. She might have even taken Lillian herself. She lied to me, and I can't just...
He made it that far without taking a breath, saying each sentence with the intense concentration of a toddler trying to stack blocks. Then his composure dissolved. He shut his eyes, his nostrils dilated, and he curled himself inward until his forehead was resting on his knees. He let out a single quivery sound, like he was trying to match his pitch to a tuning fork. He cried for about a minute. Nobody comforted him. Very slowly, Rivas let his hand slip off Shep's shoulder.
"You're breaking and entering, Navarre," Rivas said. It was the most calm, reasonable tone I'd ever heard him take. Somehow that didn't comfort me any. "You're holding a gun in somebody else's house, and there's a police officer present. I'd be very careful if I were you. In fact, unless you shoot real well with your left hand, I'd set that gun down on the carpet before I said another word."
"Trace," Angela Cambridge said gently, "if you care for Lillian..."
Zeke Cambridge told his wife to be quiet. The banker's watery eyes were staring intently at my forehead. Maybe he was imagining a bullet hole opening there. Dan sat up. I could see him slowly stacking those mental blocks again, trying to get control over his face, his emotions.
his voice. Finally, he wiped his wet cheeks with the base of his palm so forcefully he left scratches from his gold watch band.
Go ahead, Navar. You're here to get even with me. This is your big chance. Tell them how stupid I was. I thought I could handle Garza, then Carnal.
I'm not here to talk about your mistakes, Dan.
I put Lillian in danger and probably got those other people killed, and all the time my mother was... She was telling me...
He faltered, looking at Mr. Cambridge.
At least believe me that I didn't know. If I'd known about her and the mob...
Mr. Cambridge's cold expression didn't change.
Don't be too hard on yourself, son.
Absolutely, I said. Don't be too hard on your mother, either. Her biggest mistake was confiding in the wrong people, Dan, like you are. Dan's blonde eyebrows knit together. His body was swaying just slightly counterclockwise, like he was magnetically correcting for true north.
What are you talking about, Navar? Lillian's parents deserve to know what's going on. It's my responsibility to tell them.
He turned toward Zeke Cambridge for support. Cambridge offered none. Dan looked away, eyes a little hungrier. It reminded me of the time I was 8, watching a javelina die in the woods and wondering if skinning the ugly thing would finally merit a positive response from my dad's impassive face.
He can't give it to you, Dan.
Dan looked at me, puzzled. Approval, I said. Somebody to pat your head and give you permission for what you did and tell you how proud they are. Mr. Cambridge can't give you that.
Go ahead, Lieutenant. Tell Dan he did the right thing a few more times. Call him Kid. He needs the safety net.
Revis's hand stayed relaxed next to the parabellum. The only sign that Jay was tense was the tendon on the left side of his neck, which pulsed out every few seconds. Dan was swaying a little more. He brought his hand up to his cheeks absently and ran his fingers along the scratches like he was just realizing they were there.
How do you know your mother went to the mob? I asked him.
How do you know that's who she's protecting? Did she tell you that?
Dan closed his eyes tight.
She didn't need to, did she? After seeing Bo Carnow and the Hilton like that, after what you said, it's obvious.
You told me what was obvious when we talked at Little Hips, Dan. Turned out the obvious was wrong.
Mr. Cambridge was still boring an imaginary hole through the center of my head. Angela Cambridge was crying silently. I raised the Sheridan knockabout.
This is the gun that killed Randall Halcombe and Bo Carnow. Single-shot pistol, Dan. Out of production since 1962. Not the kind of weapon a serious violent criminal would favor, but it works all right for an old Navy marksman who wants personal protection or some target practice or an occasional murder when his back's against the wall.
I glanced at Mr. Cambridge, then at Jay Revis.
You folks jump in any time you want.
Dan had his hands out like I was about to rush him.
Wait a minute. You can't stand there and tell me.
I took out the first disc, the one that Maya and I had found in Lillian's statuette. I held it up.
This is half of what you're trying to get from Bo Carnow. The other half is sitting on the Cambridge's coffee table. What does that tell you?
The muzzle of my borrowed Sheridan swung toward the right almost by itself. I hadn't seen Revis move, but somehow he had his 9mm in hand. He was aiming it at my chest.
It tells me I'm using my good hand, Navar, and I got 8 rounds. How many you got?
I opened my left hand and let the 22 drop.
For the first time in the 15-some-odd years that I'd known him, Zeke Cambridge smiled.
Chapter 62.
I should have shot you the first time you left my daughter.
Mr. Cambridge sounded apologetic, smiling a sour little smile, like he was regretting a practical joke that went awry 50 years ago.
I wanted to track you down and kill you for breaking her heart, Trace. Ah, should have done it.
Don't feel too bad, I said. You had other things to worry about. The S&L crisis, the bad investments Lillian used to blame your foul moods on. Chef Construction, for instance. I tried to keep my voice even, unconcerned. I'm not sure I managed it. I had to drop the CD so it wouldn't be quite so obvious how badly my hands were shaking. Angela Cambridge stepped next to Dan and took his arm.
Dear, why don't we?
She started to whisper before he pushed her away. The muscles in Dan's face seemed to be conducting a system-wide test. His cheek twitched slightly, then his jaw, eyebrow, nose. He was staring at me with a look I would have called anger if his eyes hadn't been so empty.
You can't tell me, he started.
He opened his mouth for the next word, but it didn't come out.
You get it, don't you, Dan?
I asked. About the time your dad was making those hefty college tuition payments to SMU, Chef Construction was so deep in debt that they were on the verge of dragging their main creditor, Crockett S&L, into bankruptcy with them. Until the Cambridges assumed control of the company, that is. Then they turned their liability into a gold mine. With a little help from Fernando Asante at City Hall, I looked at Mrs. Cambridge. How many millions did Travis Center make for your husband, Angela? How much was he figuring on making this time around with the fine arts complex? She wasn't bothering to wipe away the tears anymore. They made her face look glazed, like a very old pastry. Angie Gardner, I said. When I saw the picture of you with the fighter pilot, your maiden name didn't mean anything to me. Then I went out to Blanco, the ranch where Randall Halcombe was killed, right next to land owned by the Gardner family. That's why Lillian and Beau happened to be out there that night. Your husband and Lillian both had the unfortunate idea of using the family land that weekend for different reasons. Behind her, Mr. Cambridge was absolutely still. His smile had faded. For his part, Rivas looked content. He was half-standing, half-sitting on the backrest of the couch, resting the butt of the 9mm on his knee. He didn't appear to be in any hurry to shoot me. Probably he didn't get to hold people at gunpoint as often as he'd like.
Danny boy, he said pleasantly, be a pal, get that disc at Navarre's feet. Leave the gun alone. You hear me?
Dan didn't seem to. He stayed where he was, staring in my direction with bright, completely unfocused eyes.
You're lying, Navarre, Dan decided. You've been angry at the Cambridges for years, and now you're trying to blame them for everything that's happened. That's it, isn't it?
His voice was anything but confident. He looked at the Cambridges for some confirmation, a nod, a smile, a yes. They didn't give him any. Dan turned to Lieutenant Rivas.
You're going to arrest him or something, aren't you?
Rivas nodded.
Or something.
Dan's face started doing its muscle tests again. He looked at me uneasily.